From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's show, Matthew Perry talks about Friends, Studio 60, and his new movie, Numb. He plays a screenwriter who's having a breakdown and goes from therapist to therapist seeking help. We'll also talk with Harris Goldberg, who wrote and directed Numb. It's based on his own experiences. Numb is playing this week at the Tribeca Film Festival in New York. And we'll talk with actress Sarah Polley about directing the new film Away From Her, which she adapted from an Alice Munro short story about the effects of Alzheimer's on a marriage. It stars Julie Christie. Polley starred in the Adam Egoyan films The Sweet Hereafter and Exotica. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are Matthew Perry and Harris Goldberg, who wrote and directed the new film that Perry is starring in. It's called Numb, and it's playing this week at the Tribeca Film Festival in New York. Perry is, of course, best known for his starring role on Friends and, more recently, Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip. In the new film Numb, he plays a screenwriter who's having a breakdown and can no longer function in his professional or personal life. Maybe it's the marijuana he smoked, but he feels removed from the world and even from his body. After the marijuana wears off, the numbness does not. He tries several different therapies and is diagnosed with depersonalization syndrome. The movie is based on a period in Goldberg's life. The film is a departure for Goldberg. He's best known for writing the 1999 Rob Schneider comedy Deuce Bigelow, Male Gigolo. Here's a scene from Numb. The screenwriter, played by Matthew Perry, has finally met a woman he cares about, yet it's hard for him to feel anything, and he's afraid to talk with her about his problem. Talk therapy hasn't gotten him very far, so he's ready to try medication. The scene starts with a voiceover.
I couldn't hide my condition from her forever. If I had any chance with Sarah, I had to speed up my recovery. So I went with another doctor who specialized in a big word, which meant talking, take drugs.
So, Dr.
Richmond.
Richmond, here's the thing. I have met and I think fallen in love with the most beautiful, incredible, weird woman on the face of the planet. She's so pretty. She thinks she has a big head, but she doesn't. And last night we consummated our relationship, which is to say that I had sex. Well, we had sex, and it should have felt really good. I mean, it should have felt really good. But I was so focused on her not seeing the pen that I stole, which she saw me steal, but I told her that I returned it, but I didn't return it. I just stole another pen. So all that was flying through my brain when I was supposed to so f***ing help.
Matthew Perry, Harris Goldberg, welcome to Fresh Air. Harris, let me start with you. What is depersonalization, which is the condition that your character has in the movie?
Well, it's kind of an offshoot of anxiety. It's sort of in that realm. And really what it is it's a sort of a chronic state of feeling like you're watching yourself in a movie and everything around you. It's like this sort of dreamlike state, and it's a pretty uncomfortable feeling, and it's like there's anxiety and then there's panic attacks, and this is kind of like one step above it. And what they know so far is that it's kind of a defense mechanism from too much stress that you're receiving. And, you know, some people, I think, are vulnerable to it and have that sort of, you know, aspect inside themselves that if they're stressed too much, they can get it. But they really don't know that much about it, and it's just starting to really open up where people there's more people that are suffering from it than you know, you can really imagine. It's kind of mind-boggling. So,
did you have it?
Yes, very much so for a long time, and that's what made me, write the movie in the first place.
Matthew Perry, why did you want to star in Numb, which is about a writer who has this kind of detachment from reality through this anxiety syndrome?
Well, for me personally, I had just taken some time off because Friends had come to an end, and I was very lucky to be able to not have to work for a while. And I read this script, and I related to a lot of it in my own life. This character's isolation and this character's fear and his kind of desperate attempt to improve his life on a daily basis, I completely related to. So I read the script, and then I had a meeting with Harris a couple of days later, and we just talked about what he had gone through and what this character goes through. And I thought it was just an excellent opportunity for me to really do something different. There was less pressure to be funny, although there is comedy in the movie. But it was this guy's desperate struggle to improve his life. And I really related to it. The character holed himself up in his house for weeks at a time. I've done that in the past. And I just thought it was an excellent opportunity to do something different for me. And I was also moved by the story. So,
you know, one of the things that most people hope to achieve by fame is desirability, that everybody will want to spend time with you. You can go to the best dinners or parties and have your choice of partners or whatever. And you're talking about identifying with the isolation that the character feels and identifying with, like, holding yourself up for weeks, you know, at home. What made you want to isolate yourself, or what made you feel isolated? Because I'm assuming you're referring to a time when you were well-known and could have been, you know, in a very social world.
I would like to say at this point that I feel that I am still very well-known.
Yes.
No, I'm just kidding. No. What I was talking about was I think dealing with friends. I got that show when I was 24 years old, and the kind of the white hot flame of fame at that point was pretty disillusioning to me. At first, it was kind of everything I'd ever wanted, and I was getting all this attention, and it was wonderful. But then I kind of realized that it wasn't real, and that it was sort of this existed in this, you know, kind of ether, and it became kind of scary to me. So I spent a lot of time, you know, at home watching TV during that time and just not wanting to deal with reality. And that's really what I related to most in this story.
What was scary?
Just that the world kind of changed overnight, and doors that were, you know, closed were now open, and creatively that was good. But it just, you know, if you're fortunate enough or unfortunate enough to be in a situation that becomes that huge overnight, just the entire world changing is scary in and of itself.
Now, Harris Goldberg, you wrote Deuce Bigalow, Male Gigolo, which I confess I haven't seen. But my impression is it's not among the most introspective of comedic movies. And it's probably not about someone who's really trapped in his head. So when you became the kind of person who is really trapped in his head and who felt really isolated from, you know, separated from the physical world, did you feel like your whole sense of who you, what your material ought to be, changed too? I mean, could you not even identify with the kind of writing that you'd been doing?
No, actually, a lot of those movies I wrote during this entire state. But I was just, you know, I'd come from a comedy writing background. You know, as I said, my older brother had written Stripes and Meatballs, and I grew up with the whole Second City thing in Toronto. So when I got here, I sort of, you know, hit Fast and Furious with sort of this broader kind of comedy thing, which I never really liked, to be honest with you, but I was just good at it. I don't know why, but it was just sort of, you didn't have to think that much. And it was scary to kind of write things that were more personal and stuff. So I wrote all those movies during those years, but I just got to a point where I just couldn't do it anymore. I just didn't want to write something that just didn't mean anything to me. So I really just sat down and write this for me. I didn't think anything would happen to it, but it just felt good. It was very cathartic, and it felt like the words were, I was finally writing words that I really wanted to write, and I was relating to what I wanted to write and the feelings, you know, of what was going on. So when I met with Matthew, you know, I was always a big fan of Matthew, but I just had this gut feeling that there was this side to him that was so underrated and not even touched, that it was a huge opportunity for me. And when I met him and we had a fairly lengthy conversation, I realized this was the guy.
Just another question about what you were writing. It just seems to me like if you were living in this nightmare dream state, which is how you describe your anxiety condition, then how do you get to the point where you can even write comedy?
Well, it actually got so bad that I would sometimes go to the beach, Malibu Beach, and I would lie on the sand, just staring up at the you know, the sky, and I would have somebody, I would just dictate the script to somebody who would write notes down, and then I'd go and transcribe it. That's how bad it got. And I think I was doing this film called Without a Paddle at the time, which was a Paramount film that, you know, did very well, but I can't even remember writing two lines of it. Comedy is like a, it's like a defense mechanism for me, and it has always been. I was always sort of the class clown. It's a very, you sort of follow these patterns that you kind of, you have these bag of tricks that you can kind of go back to over and over again, which are kind of these rhythms that you know will make people laugh, that will know, you know, that people will like you if you get into that realm. And it's sort of a secure place to be. And to break out of that and not do that is very, very difficult. And so I just did that for a long time because I was good at it, and that's what everyone expected of me. So, you know, that's what, those are the kind of projects the studios wanted me to do. And it worked for a long time, and they still want me to do it, quite frankly. But I'm hoping this movie will you know, facilitate me doing some other things that are a little deeper, you know.
Matthew Perry, unlike Harris Goldberg, you were a really, like, well-known public figure when you'd go through periods of, like, isolation or whatever. And you also went through a period of being in rehab and so on, and that was written up in the press. So it must be really hard to go through periods like that when you're living, you know, under the microscope.
It must be hard to go through periods of like that when I'm living under the microscope. Yes, of course it was. Yes, I have, unfortunately, a rather well-documented history with having to deal with certain issues in my life on the public level. I've managed to kind of turn that around, though, for me, where it gives me much more of an opportunity now to help other people who are going through similar struggles.
Mm-hmm.
It also made it impossible for me to just go to a bar and have a drink, because if you're on the cover of People magazine in rehab, you're going to turn some heads. So I turned it into a positive. But all of that stuff is what helped me relate to this character and this movie.
Yeah, yeah. In what ways? Like, what could you draw on from your own experiences to help you understand what the character was going through?
Well, you know, drugs do play a factor in this movie. And as we touched on earlier, the isolation and just sort of when you're going through what, as Harris describes, what he was going through, or as what I have described what I was going through, there tends to be a dynamic that enters, that falsely enters your brain, that tells you that there's kind of a universe in play and you. And when you think that way and you don't really have the courage to stop that line of thinking, it leads to, you know, serious isolation and serious problems in your life.
The movie that we're talking about is Numb, and it's a movie about a comedy writer with an anxiety disorder starring Matthew Perry and written and directed by Harris Goldberg. And Harris, thanks for talking with us about the movie. And Matthew Perry, if you don't mind, I'd like to keep you a little longer and talk with you about other aspects of your life and career, other movies and TV shows and so on.
Sure.
Numb is playing this week at the Tribeca Film Festival in New York. Before we talk more with Matthew Perry, we have to take a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Matthew Perry. He's starring in the new film, Numb. Perry became famous for his role as Chandler on Friends. Here's a scene from Friends. Joey has just given Chandler a kind of tacky gold friendship bracelet. Chandler's wearing it when he's in the coffee shop trying to pick up a girl, but she leaves when she sees the bracelet. Here he is talking with Phoebe.
Oh, this is excellent. You know, he could have got me a VCR, he could have got me a set of golf clubs, but no, he has to get me the woman repeller. The eyesore from the Liberace House of Crap.
Not that bad.
Oh, yeah, easy for you to say. You don't have to walk around sporting some reject from the Mr. T collection.
Chandler.
I pity the fool who puts on my jewelry. I do.
Before you got the part of Friends, did you do verbal witty parts? Was that the kind of role that you saw yourself as getting?
Yeah, before Friends, you know, I was auditioning for everything, and what I would find that the parts that I was getting was sitcom auditions and people that were at least trying to be funny, and I think that's largely due to growing up in Canada around a bunch of kind of goofy, funny people, and I just learned all these kind of comedic rhythms to make kids laugh or make girls laugh in school, and I would use those in my auditions, and kind of 9 times out of 10 early on I would get these little sitcom auditions that I would go out for, and at the time it was important to me to be on TV, and I thought it was, you know, a fun job. So that's certainly how it started. I mean, comedy came easier to me than drama, than the stuff that I'm playing out in the movie Numb, which is a little bit harder for me to do.
I've read that when you auditioned for Friends, you actually weren't going to audition because you were tied up with another pilot, but you ended up auditioning and you already knew the lines because you had so many friends who were auditioning for the part that you eventually got. What was it like for you to audition for the part, having heard friends of yours do it in their way? Like you'd already heard so many versions of the character.
Well, that was a very interesting time because I, you know, had for years been doing the kind of jobs we were talking about, and was off the market because I'd done another pilot that year just for the money. The pilot was about baggage handlers in the year 2194 at the LAX airport, and needless to say, it wasn't very good because it was.
Could have been more dynamic after September 11th, right?
Yes,
it could have been
exactly.
A thriller.
It was about futuristic baggage handlers, but what that did was it rendered me off the market for that pilot season, and then all of a sudden this wonderful script at the time called Friends Like Us came around, and it just had a part in it that leapt off the page as something that was very similar to me and had my rhythms, and it was about a guy who. Was sort of trying to distract everybody from how miserable he was all the time by being funny. And so a lot of my friends, comedic out-of-work actors tend to gravitate towards one another, and we would have lunch and hang out all the time. And this part came around, and a lot of people saw that it was sort of similar to me, and because I was off the market, they had asked me to run the scene with them, and it was, and, you know, help them with their auditions. And finally, after the fourth person did, I just said, "Well, listen, I think I've got a really good line on this character. Why don't you let me just do this scene for you and just take any choices that you like?" And a couple of guys I did that for, and they did very well on those choices and got to network and got to the final levels. And I was, you know, I was a little disappointed, of course, because I thought that the show was going to be good and I couldn't be on it. And then what ended up happening was, some of the powers that be at the network and the studio saw the pilot that I did, the futuristic baggage handler show, and decided it probably wasn't going to get picked up. So I got a phone call from my agent saying, you know, you have an audition for the show on Wednesday. And at that point, when I got that phone call, I knew, and I've never felt that way before in my life and probably never will again, I knew that I was going to get the job. I knew that it was going to change my life just even before I went in to read for it.
Now, how did you get the part in Studio 60, which is in hiatus now, hoping it comes back? And on that you play, this is there's two TV shows that recently premiered that are kind of like backstage at Saturday Night Live kind of shows. There's the comic one, and then Studio 60 is more of a drama done by, you know, written by Aaron Sorkin, who did The West Wing, which you had a part on for one of the arcs. So how did you end up playing the head writer on the show in Studio 60?
I had little or no interest in returning to television because my theory at the time was I'd already been fortunate enough to be on one of the better shows, so why go back? And I just completed this TNT movie that we shot in Canada called The Ron Clark Story, and I was in my hotel and my manager called and said that Aaron Sorkin had written a pilot about backstage at a Saturday Night Live type show. And I just immediately wanted to get my hands on it. And they emailed the script to me. And at about 2 o'clock in the morning in the business center of one of these hotels, I just read it on the computer. And by the time I had finished it, I thought to myself, oh boy, I guess I'm going to have to do another television show. Because the character was so great and the writing was so wonderful that... So I emailed Aaron Sorkin. I got a hold of his email address and just let him know that I'd read the script. I thought it was wonderful. And, you know, the character of Matt, the writer, had spoken to me, and he emailed me the next day and said, well, I'm glad it spoke to you because I wrote it for you. And it kind of went on from there.
After years of playing Chandler on Friends, do you feel like the writing rubbed off on you? Like, you were already witty, I'm sure, but do you feel like you became like even more witty because you were doing these great lines for years?
I suppose so. I mean, it really was sort of the perfect marriage with that whole thing just had like a magic dust on it. I mean, it was the greatest director at the time and just the wonderful writers, and they got a great cast. And it just came very naturally to me, and it kind of fed off. We kind of fed off each other. I would come up with lines. They would come up with lines. And it just was exactly, it was sort of like, you know, just a slightly funnier version of my real life, because they had, you know, I had writers for me on Friends. But I would say it certainly did. We did feed off each other, and this was a very interesting, funny character. So, you know, you learn those rhythms, and I had a lot of those rhythms going in, so they worked off that too.
Matthew Perry, he's starring in the new film Numb, which is playing this week at the Tribeca Film Festival. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of Villette, Charlotte Bronte's last novel, in stores and online at bn.com. And from creditcards.com, an online destination for consumers to search, compare, and apply for credit cards, on the web at creditcards.com. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose, at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Matthew Perry talks about his role on NBC's Studio 60, and actress Sarah Polley talks about directing the new film Away From Her. It's about a longtime marriage that's transformed when the wife loses her memory to Alzheimer's. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Matthew Perry. He's starring in the new film, Numb. He's a star of Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, which is currently in hiatus. He plays the head writer of a network sketch comedy show, kind of like Saturday Night Live. Here's a scene from the pilot of Studio 60. Perry is at an award ceremony, seated at a table. He falls off his chair.
Whoa! Sorry. That was strange. I'm sorry.
You okay?
Yeah. I'm on some medication right now that I guess makes me not know where chairs are.
He means he's on back medication.
Yeah.
How'd you hurt your back?
It happened when a surgeon sliced it open with a knife.
He had back surgery a few days ago.
You're on Vicodin?
Yeah. I may have exceeded the recommended dosage.
Should you be out of bed this soon?
I play with pain.
Well, they haven't gotten to your category yet. They're doing the awards between courses this year.
Where's your wife?
Sitting right next to her husband. I was just talking to you.
Sure. I'm on a little Vicodin and some Percocet and a steroid called Nortisone, side effect of which is mania. I swear to God, it says so right on the bottle.
You're here alone?
Completely alone.
Studio 60 was created by Aaron Sorkin, who also created The West Wing. I asked Matthew Perry if Sorkin wrote Perry's Studio 60 part to show off Perry's verbal facility and cynicism.
Yeah, I think so. I think in that character, and now I know in that character, he was trying to write himself. And Aaron Sorkin is one of the biggest freaky Friends fans in the world. It just happens to be that he's seen every episode like 15 times, and he, you know, I guess was a fan of my work on that show. And then when I came to do The West Wing, which was a much more toned down version, a much more dramatic performance than what I had done on Friends. So, you know, for whatever reason, he had written the part for me. And the guy is slightly cynical. He's messed up. He's dark. He's a genius. He's all the things that that Aaron Sorkin is. And what the show, as these things tend to happen over the last year, the show is that character has become sort of a combination of Aaron and myself.
Yeah, and one of the things that you guys have in common, in addition to being like smart and maybe a little cynical and funny and all of that, you also have like a period of like drug problems in your background, as does your character. And I wonder if that kind of helps link you to the character and to each other.
I think so. The character in the pilot was on Vicodin because of back surgery, and that obviously leapt off the page for me, because I thought it, you know, afforded him to be a little freer and a little crazier in the pilot and a little darker. So, you know, I've had my history with that, and he's had his history as well. They're both very separate histories, but, you know, they both, you know, there's a lot of that darkness in Hollywood. There's a lot of that kind of history in writing rooms all over the place. So, you know, that just added to my interest in the project, that's for sure.
Do you have a favorite scene from Studio 60 so far?
A favorite scene from Studio 60? Well, I mean, I think my favorite, just personally, my favorite episodes have been the pilot, and then we did a Christmas episode that I really liked, and then there was another episode where Matt Albee, my character, starts to take Vicodin and starts to remember when he first came to Studio 60, an episode called The Friday Night Slaughter that just personally means a lot to me.
Do you remember the first time you saw yourself on film or on video, and how that jived or didn't jive with your self-image of yourself?
Yeah, it's very interesting. You know, a lot of actors don't watch their own stuff, and a lot of actors watch a lot of it, and I'm probably somewhere in the middle. I mean, at first, as a young actor, when I was 16 or 17, I couldn't get enough of it. It was just, you know, it was just so much fun to be able to see my work on television. And now I'm less apt to watch it, because I still sort of watch it with that juvenile kind of eye. You know, I could be doing the most important scene in the world, and I'm more concerned about what my hair looks like or, you know, what I'm wearing. So it's a very bizarre profession us actors have put ourselves into. Because, you know, you can see it. You know, it's like in other professions, you're kind of submitting your work and it's on a piece of paper and you, people either like it or not, but it's your work. This is, it's you.
Did you look like you expected to? Were you surprised at seeing yourself the way other people see you?
Did I look like I expected myself to look? Because
mirrors are different than cameras.
They are. I think I probably looked like I thought I was going to look, but it's what's going on in my head that's the problem. As I said, I'm like pointing, like I'll look immediately at what I think are the bad things before the good. Mm-hmm. That's why I try not to watch it too often.
No, I know when you were growing up, your father did Old Spice ads. And for anybody who doesn't know or remember Old Spice, it was a kind of like aftershave and cologne. It was really, really popular in the 60s and I think in the 70s too. So your father was the guy who did the commercials on TV for Old Spice?
Yeah, that's actually led to most of my problems because my father is the handsomest man in the world. So that's led to why I look at myself on TV in the first place and also why I immediately go to the problems. But yeah, that was a lot of you guys probably remember there was that Old Spice commercial where the sailor has like a tote bag and he's whistling and all the women are...
Right.
You know.
So was it a lesson in what show business was like to have a father who was famous from commercials?
Well, it was an interesting lesson on all fronts to have a father in this business because I got to see the highs and lows because he would, he would have one year that was just off the charts successful and then he would have a year that wasn't. And, you know, he's one of those actors that have, managed to work for 40 years in this business. I saw a lot of the highs and lows. I would see, like, him go out for pilots and either get them or not and, what that kind of does to your attitude on a daily basis. So, his big lesson to me was to make sure that there's something else in your life that is more important than acting or you'll go bananas. And so I've tried to follow that, and I know that he feels that way too.
So your mother was the press secretary to Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau. So one parent is exposing you to, like, Hollywood, and the other to politics. What was your impression of the political world growing up?
Well, I was absolutely fascinated by it. And she was around during Jean Chrétien's liberal leadership campaign, and I was right there as a, 12-year-old kid just watching all of that happen and watching, all those campaigns, and it was just fascinating. And it was bizarre because my mother was sort of in the public eye when I was a kid as well, just from a completely different arena. But I was fascinated by it as a kid and watching all these people gather together and celebrate all these politicians. It was really fun.
Did you see her on TV a lot? Did she have to make a lot of public statements?
I did. I saw her. I saw her on TV a lot, especially during the campaigns and stuff, because she was always kind of, around. So it was really an interesting time.
So you grew up in an environment where the people who you knew best, your parents, were on TV a lot. So I guess did that make it any more or less of a big deal to be on TV yourself?
Well, the most interesting thing was, I grew up in Canada, in Ottawa, Canada, and with my mom, and the way that I would see my father on a regular basis was on TV. He would call me up and say, I'm doing an episode of Mannix or I'm doing an episode of this. And that's the way I got to kind of see my dad. So I really think I generated a huge respect for television and for the industry because of that.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. This was really fun.
Matthew Perry. He's starring in the new film Numb, which is playing this week at the Tribeca Film Festival. Coming up, Sarah Polley talks about directing the new film Away From Her. This is Fresh Air. What happens to a long marriage when the wife's memory of the relationship begins to be erased by Alzheimer's disease? That's the premise of the new movie Away From Her, which is based on an Alice Munro short story. My guest Sarah Polley wrote and directed the film. It's the first time she's directed a feature-length film. She's been acting since childhood and is best known for her starring roles in Adam Egoyan's films Exotica and The Sweet Hereafter. Away From Her stars the Canadian actor Gordon Pinsent and Julie Christie. It's a rare starring role for Christie. She doesn't make many movies anymore. In the 60s and 70s, she starred in such films as Dr. Zhivago, Don't Look Now, Shampoo, and McCabe and Mrs. Miller. Let's start with a scene from Away From Her. Fiona and Grant Anderson have been together for nearly 50 years, but now that her Alzheimer's symptoms are worsening, they have agreed she should move to an Alzheimer's facility where she can be taken care of. The facility has an enforced 30-day waiting period before anyone can visit. When Gordon returns after 30 days, Fiona has forgotten who he is. She thinks he's another resident with Alzheimer's, and she tells him about her new male friend, who she actually thinks she knew when she was a child visiting her grandparents. She describes to Gordon where her grandparents lived.
Fiona, I know where your grandparents lived. It's where we lived. We live.
Really? I better go back. He thinks he can't play without me sitting there. It's silly. I hardly know the game anymore. I'm afraid you'll have to excuse me.
Will you be through, sir?
We should be. I mean, it depends. If you ask that grim-looking lady over there nicely, she'll get you a cup of tea.
No, I'm fine.
I can leave you then? You can entertain yourself? Must all seem strange to you. But you'll be surprised how soon you get used to it. You'll get to know who everybody is, except that some of them are pretty well off in the clouds, you know. Can't expect them all to get to know who you are.
Sarah Polley, welcome back to Fresh Air. Why did you want to make a movie about the effects of Alzheimer's disease on a marriage when you're still in your 20s and you're not going to be facing this anytime soon?
I think in a way it's probably precisely because of my age that I was really interested in looking at this story and wanting to make it into a film. I found it when I first read the Alice Munro short story that it's based on, The Bear Came Over the Mountain. I found it to be the most kind of profound and interesting portrait of love and of a marriage that I'd ever read. And I think it's because I was at the beginning of a relationship and the beginning of what was to become a marriage that this just seemed like such an interesting way to spend my time, to be thinking about what it might look like after 44 years.
Part of what the movie's about is how do you express your love to someone who no longer even realizes that they're married to you?
Mm-hmm.
And what is the nature of jealousy when your wife has Alzheimer's and seems to be bonding with another man who also has Alzheimer's, and neither of them comprehend that they're that there's another person in their life, that they're married already. Were you interested in that? Like, what is the nature of jealousy when the person who you love has no memory anymore?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think what was so compelling to me about the story was that it was this incredibly intricate portrait or exploration into the nature of unconditional love. And what does it mean to kind of give of yourself in a way that will not be acknowledged. And I think in the case of this story as well, another really fascinating part of it to me was the idea of this man's guilt, that he has not always been a saintly husband, that, you know, there have been wounds that he's perpetrated in the past and affairs that he's had, and that there's this strange, almost poetic justice that he perceives in her forgetting him and seemingly falling in love with another man in front of his eyes. So I think that for me, it was really interesting to see, you know, what do you do with that? In a strange way, for this character, I think he's able to discover the kind of husband he always wanted to be through her disease.
Now, Julie Christie stars as the woman with Alzheimer's disease in your movie, and she's most famous for her early starring roles in Dr. Zhivago, Darling, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Shampoo, Don't Look Now. And you've already worked with her in a couple of movies.
Mm-hmm.
And Hal Hartley's No Such Thing, and in the movie The Secret Life of Words. I want to ask you about working with her, playing somebody who has no memory, when in fact she has serious problems with memory in real life.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to play you a short excerpt of an interview I did with Julie Christie in 2002.
Sure. I think this one became quite famous, didn't it? It got written about a lot.
Did it?
Yeah, I'm excited to hear it. I've never heard it.
Okay, so I'm going to play you and our listeners a short clip. Now, she told me that she had bad memory problems and that a neurologist told her she had what was described as autobiographic amnesia, meaning it's hard for her to remember parts of her own life. Mm. So she really couldn't answer my questions about her classic films because her memories just weren't clear enough to talk mm-hmm. about that part of the past. And here's one of the things she had to say.
I've always had a problem with my memories. Ages and ages ago, I have a problem doing plays for that reason. I was doing we were doing Uncle Vanya on Broadway. Now, when was that? I can't remember dates at all. So I can't tell you when it was. And remembering those lines was a nightly horror, so it took away from the actual acting, and I really have a real problem remembering lines. Of course, in films, it's not nearly as serious, but it's still there. I mean, you still have to remember and say things.
Now, you're not that interested in making a lot of movies. You're very selective, and you're just as happy to work very little. If you didn't feel that way, if you wanted to work a lot more, I imagine this is a subject you wouldn't be very comfortable talking about. It's something you might be covering up, in fact.
What, my memory?
Yeah.
Never thought about it. you mean because the director of my dreams might not hire me? Don't
exactly.
worry, director of my dreams,
exactly.
I'll pull it off. If somebody what listens to this and thinks they don't want to hire me because of my memory, I'll just... It's just, I don't think they would because, you know, they know, they've seen me. They know what they want. Memory or no memory, people know what they want. The memory doesn't get in the way of what the audience sees. That's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
It gets in my way, but not in the way of what the audience sees.
That's an excerpt of an interview I recorded with Julie Christie in 2002. And Christie is now starring in Sarah Polley's new movie, Away From Her. And Christie plays a woman who has Alzheimer's disease. So, Sarah, when you cast Julie Christie, who you'd already worked with in a couple of films, did you know about her memory problems and the problems that she would have learning lines for the movie?
Well, what's interesting is actually just before I read this short story, I think that that interview just played got actually written about, and it was sort of taken totally out of context in a few papers, I think, in England that reported that Julie Christie had Alzheimer's disease and, you know, her son was very confused and, you know, she doesn't have a son. So it was kind of, you know, this really hysterical thing. And it was, I think, quite hurtful and pretty upsetting for her that it had been taken out of context in that way. And she wrote a brilliant rebuttal to it in The Guardian.
I didn't even know about this.
Yeah. No, that interview became quite sort of infamous in a way. And I think that, you know, yes, I know about Julie's concerns about her memory. I have not, to be honest with you, noticed in my relationship with her any significant signs of memory loss. And on this film, she didn't forget a single line and she had whacks of dialogue. So I haven't experienced it firsthand, but I know that she feels she has, you know, a very big problem with her memory. I haven't noticed that myself. But I did think of that when approaching her with this, because I know it's something she's concerned about. But I also thought of it in the context of that, you know, really awful story being written. And in a strange way, this being a bit of a middle finger to that guy, you know, that's like she's so kind of fine with that kind of thing that she's sort of willing to embrace playing this person without fear of, you know, people taking it completely out of context again. What I really wanted was that incredibly magical, witty, intelligent, ephemeral quality that only I think she has. And I think this character is someone who, you know, has this kind of quality of being incredibly engaged and incredibly vivid, incredibly conscious of the person they're with. And then a minute later, you're kind of chasing them a bit. And I couldn't think of anybody else who could play that in the same way as Julie Christie. So in a way, I kind of wrote this for her.
So you really did. You wrote it for her.
I did, yeah. As soon as I read the short story, I just couldn't stop seeing Julie's face. And in fact, the character's a bit older than her. But there's something about her mischievousness and that strange ephemeral quality she has that I couldn't think of anyone else but Julie.
One of the things I really enjoyed about her performance is that she's still so beautiful. And watching her get older and still be beautiful, it's a different kind of beauty than when she was in her 20s. but it's still really beautiful. So it's a pleasure to, you know, to watch her face.
I mean, she's stunning. And it was funny when we were working, Luc Montpellier, the DOP, and I, we just kind of kept creeping up closer and closer on her face because it's just sort of intoxicating. I mean, you can't get enough of it. And she has, I think, a much more beautiful face and a much more interesting face than she's ever had. So it really sort of made us just want to sort of linger as much as we could on her.
My guest is Sarah Polley. She directed the new movie Away From Her. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actress Sarah Polley. She directed the new movie, Away From Her, about a marriage disrupted by Alzheimer's disease. This is the first feature film that you've written and directed yourself. Mm-hmm. You've done shorts before. Anna McGoyan, who is a Canadian director and writer, and you've been in a couple of his films, The Sweet Hereafter and Exotica, he's an executive producer of mm-hmm. your new movie, Away From Her. Did he give you any helpful advice in directing?
Well, absolutely. And Adam's been a big mentor to me. And on all of my short films, he's sort of been available to me whenever I had questions and has been so supportive. And on this film, he kind of, you know, was there when I needed him. So if I just sort of had a moment where I couldn't possibly know what to do because of my lack of experience in terms of not knowing how to communicate something or not knowing how to get something, he would be the person I would turn to. So he wasn't sort of hands-on involved, but he was always sort of available to me, which was such a great asset to have.
Any lasting advice that you remember?
I think it was, you know, there were a couple of like early moments, you know, in the rehearsal process where, you know, actors had a few script notes and I didn't know what I thought of them and I didn't know how to deal with it. And he just sort of gave me a long speech about, you know, not being defensive in moments like that and being able to really listen and yet be clear about, you know, how that fits into your sort of broader plan. And I thought that was sort of great. You know, it's the kind of thing that I think as a first-time filmmaker, you could become defensive in those moments and you would learn with experience, you know, that it's actually a really appropriate time to listen. And I don't know that I would have known that without him there. So
in the film, when the husband brings his wife to like an Alzheimer's residential facility, he's told that he can't see her until 30 days later mm-hmm. because that's their standard procedure. Is that a typical procedure? I'd never heard of anything like
typical.
That.
But it's not typical. No, it's something that I don't think is ever used. I don't know about the United States, but in Canada, it's not used at all in public facilities anymore. There are a couple of private facilities that have sort of similar recommendations that people go for 15 days or so. But I think it's something that used to be a lot more common. And if you read Alzheimer's books now, there is a warning them, you know, to not go to these kinds of facilities, which implies that they exist. It's a very important device in the film because that's the time in which Fiona forgets her husband. But, you know, it's a contentious point in the film because it's certainly not indicative of, you know, a norm in these facilities.
Okay. How did you find the Alice Munro story that your movie's based on?
I had actually just finished working with Julie for the first time. We did Hal Hartley's film No Such Thing in Iceland. And I was on my way home And I was in a plane, and I, you know, there's a copy of The New Yorker that I think I had picked up. And whenever I see there's a story by Alice Munro, I read it. And this just kind of hit me. And I couldn't stop seeing Julie's face. And there were all these references to Iceland, you know, in the sort of subtext of the story. And it just sort of became a film in my mind. And I was so profoundly moved by this story. And I felt like I had so much to learn from it. And so in a strange way, I've always felt like I kind of wanted to make this film so I could walk around inside this piece of fiction.
Do you think you learned anything about acting from directing?
I think I learned a ton about acting from directing. I have no idea if it's possible to put it into use. I hope it is. Because, it's an amazing thing to sort of like leave that very subjective place of an actor and see the entire process and see how that role sort of fits into the broader picture of making a film. And I worked with actors who taught me a lot about how to embrace, you know, a filmmaker's vision and how to collaborate. And they were so unbelievably helpful to me and never at odds with what I was trying to accomplish. And I would love to kind of take what I learned from them and put them into my own process as an actor. And I guess I'll just sort of have to, you know, figure out how that works and how you actually take something you know and make it, you know, turn into behavior. I don't know.
Now, Michael Murphy, who co-stars in the movie, and he plays a man in the Alzheimer's facility, you know, somebody, one of the patients there, who develops this relationship with the Julie Christie character, and then they've both forgotten that they have spouses already.
Mm-hmm.
He'd worked with Julie Christie in McCabe and Mrs. Miller, right?
Yes, yeah.
Did you intentionally cast them because they had a movie in common?
I did like the idea of there being a history there, I think, because there's an ambiguity of whether, you know, whether or not these two people actually knew each other when they were young. They seem to think that they did, and we don't know if that's part of their disease or if it's true. But I did like the idea that there was a kind of, you know, subliminal history that we have with both of them and that they have with each other that's sort of underlying, you know, those relationships. I mean, it's a pretty subtle point, but I did like that. And Michael Murphy, I think, is, you know, probably been in more of my favorite films than almost any other actor. So he was someone that I was dying to work with as well.
So you sought him out?
Absolutely, yeah.
Sarah Polley, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. Nice to see you again.
Sarah Polley directed the new movie Away From Her. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Villette, Charlotte Bronte's last novel, in stores and online at bn.com. And from creditcards.com, an online destination for consumers to search, compare, and apply for credit cards, on the web at creditcards.com. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
A new biography of Justice Clarence Thomas explores some of the paradoxes of his life and career. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the authors Kevin Merida and Michael Fletcher of The Washington Post. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.